Chapter 4. Jack Aubrey's answer was yes, as Stephen had known very well it would be. But with what tearings of heart, what anxious self-questioning did he produce it at length, well on in the 11th hour? And what sad, longing, perhaps guilt-stricken looks did he direct at the surprise, already under sail far down there in the Tagus, as he rowed away, leaving his shipmates low-spirited, disappointed, and in some cases even bereft. Some had been angry at first. Many had said they'd always known it would be an unlucky voyage. But no man had accepted Jack's offer to give him his wages and pay his passage home, and they derived increasing comfort from the fact that it was the Diane that they personally had cut out, their own Diane, in which he was to sail, and that the two ships were to meet at a given rendezvous. A rendezvous made all the more solid and palpable by the captain's wine and cold-weather clothes, which remained on board, together with crate after crate of the doctor's books. Not only the hands, but the officers took the parting hard. Pullings was devoted to Jack, and the others had the greatest respect for him. And although they attributed less importance to Aubrey's private personal luck than did the foremast hands, it didn't leave them indifferent by any means. Furthermore, they knew very well how much easier it was to command a fierce, turbulent crew when there was a legendary figure aboard, legendary for courage, success, and good fortune. However, Stephen was able to assure Pullings that he was virtually certain of a command if he brought the Surprise home safely, and both West and Davidge felt that in such a case they would have much better chances of reinstatement. Since Aubrey was to travel to his new ship by land and with the utmost haste, he was unable to take any followers apart from his steward and coxswain, and the deserted, uncomplaining look of those he left behind was one of the hardest things about the whole operation. Yet it was clear to him, it was clear to everyone concerned, that this was still another of those naval occasions on which there was not a moment to be lost. And in a way it was just as well, since the incessant activity and the extreme difficulty of travelling fast through Portugal and northwestern Spain, in a time of armed occupation and massive destruction, with the tide of war only just receding and liable to come flooding back at any time, took Jack's mind from his deserted ship and shipmates. But nothing, travel, guilt, extreme discomfort, could take away from the deep glow in his heart. If he could stay alive for the next couple of weeks or so, he'd be gazetted and he'd have a command. The charming promises would become infinitely more solid realities, changing from what his mind believed to what his whole person knew as a living fact. The fact, however, couldn't be mentioned nor the glow acknowledged. Even the inward singing must be repressed. They travelled in a variety of hired coaches and carriages, sometimes drawn by an improbable number of animals, but always, however many or however few, running as fast as ever they could be induced to run. That is to say, Sir Joseph, Standish, whom Jack had offered a lift after their explanation, the baggage, the musical instruments, and the large number of documents Stephen needed travelled so, with Killick and Bondon, no great horsemen, sitting with the driver or up behind, except in the blinding rain of Galicia when Sir Joseph made them come inside. Jack and Stephen rode. There were great numbers of lost, stolen, strayed cavalry horses from the various armies to be had, and each travelled with a remount and a groom, pushing ahead in the evening to attend to supper and bed. It was hard going, on and on, always on and on, passing wonders without ever a pause, never so much as a glass of wine in Oporto itself, mud in the north, mud axle deep. And once a band that tried to stop the coach, but that scattered in the face of determined professional pistol and carbine fire, Yet for Blaine it was nothing like such hard going as it had been on the way down. Now he had a guide perfectly accustomed to the language and the manners of the people, familiar with the road and most of the towns, widely acquainted, so that they stayed at two country houses and one monastery, as well as the best inn the country afforded. He was also now part of a formidable armed party, including powerful sailors capable of dealing with most situations, such as freeing a bogged wheel by means of a tackle seized to a stout tree, the fall running along a dry bank so that all hands could bowse upon it. Indeed, the travelling itself was almost pleasant, and the evening was very much so. On his way down, Sir Joseph, spending public money, hadn't exactly stinted himself, but he had a certain conscience. Whereas Stephen, once he'd overcome a reluctance to part with copper, flung gold about like Jack ashore, and Aubrey had never been less than lavish whenever he'd anything to be lavish with. Having travelled like kings all day, they ran dinner and supper into one regal feast in the evening, and after it Standish would play to them. Sir Joseph was devoted to music. He appreciated Standish's playing at its true worth, and Stephen hoped that he might deal with the situation by finding the unhappy man some harmless, minor position under government. But this wasn't to be. One evening in Santiago, Standish was playing a brilliant Corelli partita entirely from memory, not a hemidemi-semi-quaver of all the multitude out of place, when Jack, who had drunk a great deal of the thin, piercing white wine from the landlady's own vineyard, was obliged to tiptoe to the door. He opened it with the utmost precaution, and a bulky officer in the uniform of the first foot guards fell into the room. He was covered with confusion, apologised most profusely for listening, fairly worshipped good music, Corelli, was it not? Congratulated the gentleman most heartily. When the music was done, they invited him to stay and drink port with them. His name was Lumley. He was in charge of the regiment's depot in Santiago. They'd already noticed a number of battered guardsmen creeping about the muddy streets. And as it so often happens in cases of this kind, they found they had a large number of acquaintances in common. When the others had gone to bed, he shared a last pot with Stephen, who gave him a discreet account of Standish and his position. "Do you think he'd be my secretary?" asked Colonel Lumley. "The duties had been very light. My clerks do most of the paperwork, but I should give a great deal to have such a violin at hand." "Seems to me quite probable," said Stephen, and he might have added, "Indeed, I believe the poor man would accept any work that would keep him alive rather than go aboard ship again and in the Bay of Biscay at that, if he hadn't thought it liable to influence even a very benevolent employer." And Colonel Lumley had, at least in these circumstances, the kindest face. Instead, he observed, "So probable that I'm sure it's worth making the offer." The offer was made and accepted. The party set off as soon after dawn as the ostlers could be roused from their straw, with Standish standing by the stable gates in the drizzle, waving until they were out of sight. His happiness, his relief, his sense of reprieve affected them all, even Bondon and Killick, who imitated post-horns on the back of the coach and made antic gestures at the passing peasants and soldiers most of the morning. But the mounting south-south-west wind, veering to south-west with heavy rain, damped their ardour, and presently Sir Joseph made them get inside again, where they sat stiff, mum and genteel, until at last the gasping mules brought the carriage down through Corunna to the port. Here Jack and Stephen were waiting for them on the quay beside the Nimble, the cutter that was to carry Sir Joseph and his party home. "This couldn't be better," said Jack, as he heaved the coach door open against the blast. "It's almost short of strength, then. And even if it don't, we may well see Ushant by Thursday evening." In the last grey twilight, Blaine looked at the streaming, shining quay, the streaming, shining mules drooping their heads under the rain, the uneasy surface of the harbour, the steeply chopped white water beyond where the tide was ebbing against the Atlantic rollers. He made no reply, but took Jack's arm and staggered across the brow into the cutter, his eyes half closed. Stephen settled with the coachman and his carbine-bearing companion, paid the grooms, telling them they might keep the horses, and so, in his turn, crossed the brow. The baggage had long since been whipped across by a line of seamen, and as soon as Stephen was aboard, they cast off fore and aft, filled the jib, and stood for the open sea. The 200-ton Nimble, 14 guns, was one of the largest cutters in the Royal Navy. And for those accustomed to doggers, hoys, galliots and smacks in general, she seemed a behemoth, particularly when she had t'gallants and even royals spread on her tall single mast. But for the rest of the world, especially those used to rated ships, she might have seemed designed for dwarves. Even Maturin, who was rather a small man, stood bent with bowed head in the cabin. Yet, as it so often happened in the Navy, she was commanded by one of the tallest officers the service possessed. He came in, having seen his cutter well clear of the land, and stood there, a pink-faced, smiling, anxious young man in a lieutenant's coat. "You're very welcome, gentlemen," he said again. "May I offer you a little something to stay you before supper? Sandwiches, for example, and a glass of Sillery?" "That would be delightful," said his guests, to whom it was clear that the sandwiches had already been cut and the wine put over the side in a net to cool. "Where's Sir Joseph?" asked the captain of the Nimble. "He turned in at once," said Jack, "because, says he, prevention's better than cure." "I hope it answers, I'm sure. Lord Nelson's coxswain told me the Admiral used to suffer most cruelly for the first few days if he'd been ashore for a while. Starbs," directing his voice through a scuttle, "light along the sandwiches and the wine." "The bubbly stuff's all very well," said Jack, looking at the light through his glass, "but for flavour, for bouquet and for quality, give me good Sillery every time. Capital wine, sir. But now I come to think of it, I don't believe I caught your name." "Fitton, sir. Michael Fitton," said the young man with a shy, expectant look. "Not John Fitton's son?" asked Jack. "Yes, sir. He often spoke about you, and I saw you once at home when I was a boy." "We were shipmates in three commissions," said Jack, shaking his hand. "Isis, Resolution, and Colossus, of course." He looked down, for it was on the gun deck of the Colossus, not 3 feet away from him, that John Fitton had been killed during the Battle of St. Vincent. At this moment, Sir Joseph, whose cupboard opened into the cabin, called out in a choking voice for his servant. And when the hurrying to and fro was over, Stephen said, gazing about, "So this is a cutter. Well, I'm prodigiously glad to have seen a cutter. Pray, why is it so called?" At another time, Jack might have replied that Stephen had seen cutters by the score, by the hundred, every time he came into home waters, and very often elsewhere, and that the rig had been carefully explained to him so that he shouldn't confuse a cutter with a sloop. But now he only said, "Why, because they go cutting along, you know, skillfully handled," smiling at young Fitton. "They're the fastest craft in the Navy." "Should you like to see over her, Doctor, when it's raining a little less?" asked Fitton. "She's remarkably large and elegant for a cutter, nearly 70 feet long. And although some people might say she wanted headroom, she's much broader in the beam than you'd think. 24 feet, but for a trifle. 24 feet, sir, I do assure you." After supper, Jack and the captain of the Nimble fell to a close discussion of the sailing of cutters, both with fore and aft and with square rig. in order to get the best out of them by as well as large. And although from time to time they remembered that Stephen was there and tried to make the question clear to him, he soon went to bed. He was, in fact, quite tired. He had reason to be. But before he went to sleep, he reflected for a while on diaries, on the keeping of diaries. The Nimble was now pitching to such an extent that Killick came in and took 7 turns about him and his cot to prevent him from being tossed out or being flung against the deckhead. But even without the constriction, it would have been impossible to make one of his habitual entries, cryptic entries, because of his strongly developed sense of privacy, and selective entries, because of his connection with intelligence. Today I should have recorded no more than the weather, the Helleborus Fetidus when we stopped to mend a trace, and the handsomely expressed gentlemanly gratitude of the men, the wholly uneducated men, to whom we gave the horses. When first I met Jack, I should have been very much more prolix. Or should I? I was terribly low in those days after the obvious inevitable failure of the Rising, the infamous conduct of so very, very many people, and of course the loss of Mona, to say nothing of the intolerable miseries in France and the destruction of all our sanguine, generous, youthful hopes. Lord, how a man can change. I remember telling James Dillon, God rest his soul, that I no longer felt loyalty to any nation or any body of men, only to my immediate friends. That Dr. Johnson was right in saying that the form of government was of no consequence to the individual, that I shouldn't move a finger to bring about the millennium or independence. And yet here I am, hurrying through this wicked sea in an attempt, however slight, at bringing about both, if the defeat of Bonaparte can be considered the one, and Catholic emancipation and the dissolution of the Union the other. When I'm at the grapes, I shall look at the diary of that year and see what, in fact, I said. Shall I remember the code? At breakfast, Michael Fitton said, "Today, Doctor, if the rain stops, you'll see the Nimble in all her glory. She's almost directly before the wind, with topsail and single-reefed square mainsail. And at the last heave, she ran off 11 knots in the best part of a fathom." "Yes," said Jack, "and you'll see the extraordinary merits of a running bowsprit. When she pitches like this..." The table took on a forward slope of 25 degrees, the hands automatically securing the toast. "The bowsprit doesn't stab into the sea and snap off short, or at the very least check her way." "How can this be achieved, for our love?" "Since a cutter's bowsprit has no steve, since it's horizontal, it can be run in on deck," they told him kindly, and promised that he should see it directly. But they were mistaken. The rain continued steadily, sweeping in vast grey swathes from the southwest, over a grey sea mottled here and there with white. And although in the dim afternoon of Thursday Jack dragged him on deck to look at Ushant, a faint white-ringed blur on the starboard bow, he couldn't be induced to go forward to see the bowsprit, nor even to climb a little way up the shrouds to view the remote ships of the Brest blockade. And the next day, when the Nimble was racing up the channel, the breeze had hauled so far forward that she now wore her fore and aft mainsail, foresail and jib. Her bowsprit was therefore run out, and it remained run out until the end of their voyage. A most remarkably fine passage that brought them into Portsmouth late on Friday afternoon, quite a warm day for May, and with no more than an intermittent drizzle. Sir Joseph, whose policy of lying motionless and eating very large quantities of dry bread had worked well after the first horrible hours, set off for London as soon as he'd taken tea and muffins at the Crown. He said to Jack, "I presume orders will be telegraphed down to Admiral Martin as soon as I've made my report, and I have little doubt that, officially or unofficially, I shall see you both early next week." They accompanied him to his post-chaise, and as they walked back, Stephen said, "I've been thinking, brother, Diana will be in a very delicate condition by now, and if we suddenly appear, it may shock her extremely. Oh, said Jack, who had been on the point of sending for horses. I suppose it might. Pen a discreet diplomatic note hinting that you might be in the neighbourhood presently, and we'll send it by Bondon or Killick, or both, in a chaise. A chaise, with Bondon and Killick getting out of it, would be sure to cause alarm. Dreadful apprehensions of bad news travelling with such speed and ostentation. A boy on a mule would be much more suitable. The boy on a mule set off with a note. My dear, pray do not be alarmed or in any way concerned. If you should see us presently, we are both perfectly well and send our love. And the men were about to set off to gaze at the Diane from a discreet distance when they ran into the port admiral, a cheerful soul who insisted on their cracking a bottle. I'm 74 today. You cannot refuse me. A number of other sea officers were in the hall, and he invited them too. Some were very well known to Jack, among them three post-captains. Like many other post-captains, they made up for their solitary state at sea by being unusually loquacious by land. The physician of the fleet was also there, together with one of the medical men from Hassler, and they too were very conversable. Talk flowed, bottles came and went, time passed. Passed. But at length the landlord's son came and stood by Stephen. Oh, Dr. Maturin, sir, he said, when Stephen paused in his account of the Basra method of setting broken bones. There's a coach outside with some ladies asking for you. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, muttered Stephen, darting from the room. Diana was at the near side window. She leant out and cried, "Oh, Maturin, my dear, what a monster you are to terrify innocent women like this!" Inside the coach, behind her, Sophie's voice rose to a high squeak. "Isn't Jack there? You said Jack would be there." Diana opened the door and offered to jump out, but Stephen took her elbows and lifted her down. "My dear, you're a fine size," he said, kissing her tenderly. "Sophie, will you come in and see Jack and Admiral Martin and a number of other sailors? They're drinking port in the dolphin room." "Oh, Stephen," called Sophie, "pray bring him out and let's all go home together at once. I don't want to lose a minute of him, nor of you either, dear Stephen." "Sure, you're right, for the moments are few. We must be in town on Tuesday, I do believe." In fact, it was on Sunday evening that a message came from the Port Admiral requiring Captain Aubrey to wait upon the First Lord in Arlington Street at 5:30 the next day. Yet, if the reprieve had been longer, they could scarcely have said any more, all of them having talked incessantly since the coach started moving back to Ashgrove Cottage from the Crown. "Arlington Street!" said Jack in a hoarse whisper. "His private house. I'm heartily glad of it, because had it been the Admiralty, I should have been in a fine quandary. Report in uniform and be presumptuous, or report in civilian clothes and be incorrect. However, I shall take uniform as well in case I have to go on. Sweetheart, it's not gone to rack and ruin all these years." "Neither the one nor the other, my dear, only the epaulettes are a little tarnished. Killick and my mother and both the girls have been blowing on your best and dry-scrubbing it with soft brushes to get the smell of mothballs out since yesterday morning. But I'm afraid it'll be much too big. You've grown pitifully thin, my poor darling." Pitifully thin or not, Jack Aubrey still made the post-chaise heel well over as he stepped into it, having kissed his family all round except for George, who'd been wearing breeches for quite some time now. They struck into the main London road at Cosham and bowled along at a splendid rate under a blue, blue sky with billowing, flat-bottomed white clouds travelling in the same direction, but at a far more stately pace. "Remarkably fine horses," observed Jack, "and a most uncommon pretty day." He whistled and then sang from Ushant to Scilly it is 35 leagues right through. Since there'd been no rain on Saturday or Sunday, the hedges All along the busy road were white with dust, but only a little way beyond them there was a living green in the wheat, oats and barley and the various leys, and in the woods and copses, with leaves coming to their glory under the brilliant sky, that it would have lifted the heart of any man, let alone one who might expect such an end to his journey. Most of the summer migrants had arrived, and there were still some passing through to northern parts. The countryside was therefore rich in birds. And as they changed horses at a village some way beyond Petersfield, Stephen heard no less than three separate cuckoos at once. He shook his head, remembering the extreme pain that call had caused him at an earlier time. But almost at once his mind was taken off by the sight of a wryneck, a bird he had much more often heard than seen. He pointed it out to Jack with the usual result. "There's a wryneck!" "Well, on the young elm to the right of..." It's gone. Wrynecks. The progress of Jack's daughters in learning and deportment under Miss O'Mara, and the albatrosses of the high and even moderate southern latitudes occupied the next stage. But after that, Jack became more and more silent. There was so very much at stake, and now the moment of decision was so very near, hurrying and even racing nearer every minute. He grew exceedingly uneasy in his mind. "I shall feel better after dinner," he said to himself, as the chaise turned off the Strand, rolled down into the liberties of the Savoy, and came to a halt at the Grapes, their accustomed inn. Mrs. Broad made them heartily welcome. Killick, travelling up on yesterday's night coach, had given her warning, and she provided them with a dinner that would have soothed any reasonable man. But at this point Jack Aubrey was not a reasonable man. His mind was fixed on the possibility of unacceptable conditions, or even downright failure, and yet mechanically, drawing no benefit from his food whatsoever. "It's my belief the captain has been called out and is going to meet some gentleman in Hyde Park," said Mrs. Broad to Lucy, for Castlereagh's duel with Canning and some other slightly less notorious encounters were still very much in the public mind. "He never even touched the pudding." "Oh, Aunt Broad, what a terrible thing to say," cried Lucy. "But sure, I never saw a man look so grim." Yet not so grim when he knocked on the door in Arlington Street as the St. James's clock struck 5:30, for now the action was engaged. The time of waiting was over. He was on the enemy's deck at last. He gave the servant his card, saying, "I have an appointment with his lordship." "Oh, yes, sir, this way, if you please," said the man, and led him to a small room opening directly off the hall. "Captain Aubrey," said Lord Melville, rising from behind his desk and stretching out his hand, "let me be the first to congratulate you. We've sorted out this wretched business at last. It's taken far longer than I could have wished for. Far, far longer than you could have wished, I fear. But it is done. Sit down and read that. It's a proof sheet of the Gazette that is now printing off." Jack looked at the sheet with a fixed, stern expression. The ringed round lines ran, May 15, Captain John Aubrey, Royal Navy, is restored to the list with his former rank and seniority, and is appointed to the Diane of 32 guns. He said, "I'm deeply sensible of your kindness, my lord." Melville went on, "And here is your appointment to the Diane. Your orders will be ready in a day or two, but of course you already know the essence of the matter from Sir Joseph. I'm so glad, we are so glad, that you're able to undertake this mission with Dr. Matchett and to keep you company, for nobody could be better qualified in every way. ideally, no doubt, you would bring those evil men Ledward and Ray back with you. But Mr. Fox, our envoy and a man of great experience in Oriental concerns, tells me that this couldn't possibly be done without injuring our subsequent relations with the Sultanate. The same, and I say it with the deepest regret, applies to their frigate, the... He looked into a folder on his desk. The Cornélie. Yet at least I most sincerely hope that the mission will frustrate and confound them, bringing them to utter and permanent discredit. And ideally, you would be able to choose many of your own officers in midshipmen, but, as you know, time presses most urgently, and unless you can catch the tail of the southwest monsoon, Mr. Fox may arrive to find the French in possession of a treaty. If you have any friends or followers within immediate reach, well and good, but this is a matter you'll discuss with Admiral Satterley. I've made an appointment for you at 9 tomorrow morning at the Admiralty, if that's convenient. Perfectly, sir, my lord, said Jack, who had recovered during Melville's steady, practised flow, and who was aware of a grave... happiness is too slight a word. Emotion filling his whole heart. Though even now he found that he was crushing his appointment, grasping it with enormous force and ruining its folds, he smoothed it discreetly and slid it into his pocket. As for Hans, Admiral Martin will, I'm sure, do his very best for you, both because their lordships command it, and because he has a very great liking for you and Mrs. Aubrey. But there again, you know the difficulties he has to contend with. And lastly, as for Mr. Fox, I had thought of arranging a dinner, but Sir Joseph thought it might be better, less formal, if you and he and Matchlin were to invite him to Black's, to a private room at Black's. Jack bowed. And speaking of that, said Melville, glancing at the clock, I trust you'll eat your mutton with us this evening. Heneage is coming, and I can imagine his disappointment at missing you. Jack said he would be very happy, and Melville continued, There, I believe that's all I have to say as First Lord. The Admirals will deal with the purely service aspect. But speaking as an ordinary mortal, may I say that my cousin William Dundas is bringing in a private bill on Wednesday to allow him to win some land from the sea. There's likely to be a very thin house, perhaps not enough for a quorum. So, if you were to look in, and if you were to approve what he says, though it would diminish your watery realm by nearly 2 square miles, why, we should take it very kindly. No one but a man far more obtuse than Maturin would have had to ask the result of the interview as Jack came running upstairs, his papers in his hand. He did it as handsomely as the thing could be done, he said. No humming and hawing, no barking about the wrong bush, no goddamn morality, just shook my hand, said, Captain Aubrey let me be the first to congratulate you and showed me these. Then, having chuckled over the Gazette again, observing that it would make poor Oldham, the post-captain who'd stepped into his seniority, look pretty blank tomorrow, he gave Stephen a minute account of the conversation, the subsequent dinner. It went down remarkably well, considering, but I believe I could have ate a hippopotamus in my relief, and the truly affecting behaviour of Heneage Dundas. He sends his very kindest wishes, by the way, and we'll look in tomorrow in case you have a free moment while he's in town. Lord, how pleased I was with the whole thing, and how pleased Sophie will be. I shall send an express. But, he went on after a hesitant pause, I do rather wish Melville hadn't asked me for a vote, not just at that time. A professional deformation, I suppose. Politics and delicacy can rarely go together, said Stephen, looking at the appointment again. But will I tell you something, brother? This is a most wonderfully auspicious date, soldiers. On this same 15th of May, a Saturday, if I remember, but in any event, just 40 days before the flood, Noah's granddaughter, Seaswar, came to Ireland with 50 maidens and 3 men. They landed, I believe, at Dunmarmark in the County Cork. She was the first person that ever set foot on an Irish strand, and she was buried at Carnsaesra in Connacht, beside which I have often sat watching the blue hares run. You astonish me, Stephen. I'm amazed. So the Irish are really Jews? Not at all. Seswar's father was a Greek. And in any case, they were all drowned in the flood. It was not for close on 300 years more that Partholan arrived. Jack reflected upon this for some little while, looking at Stephen's face from time to time, and then he said, "But here I am, prating away eternally about my own affairs, and I've never even asked what kind of a day you spent. Not a very pleasant one, I fear." "That's quite mended now, I thank you. Your news would have mended anything, but I was put out, I confess. Indeed, I flew into a passion. I went to my bank, and there I found that the dogs had carried out almost none of the instructions I'd left with them, nor those I'd sent from Lisbon. There were even some small annuities still unpaid because of trifling informalities in my initial order. Then, when I desired them to send a considerable sum in gold down to Portsmouth as soon as we were aboard, they observed that gold was exceedingly hard to come by, that if paper money really wouldn't answer, they would do their best for me, that I should have to pay a premium. I pointed out that in the first place, they had deposited a very much larger sum in gold with them, that it was absurd to expect me to pay for metal that was my own. And eventually I carried my point, though not without the use of some very warm expressions, such as the nautical lobcock and bugger. Quite rightly applied, too. I'm sure I should never have been so moderate. Stephen, why don't you change to Smith, the brother of the Smith we dined with just before we left? For my part, I shall never desert whores, because sooner or later they do everything I ask, and because they treated me so well when I had no money at all. But still, I do have an account down there with Smith, because it's so convenient, particularly for Sophie. In your place, I should cashier your lobcocks out of hand and place everything with Smith. I shall do so, Jack. As soon as that gold is aboard the Diane, I shall write them a letter in which every legal requirement is fulfilled 3 times over. I shall have it drafted by your lawyer. Come in." It was Lucy, sent to know what the gentleman chose to eat for supper. Mrs. Broad thought a venison pasty and an apple pie would be very lovely. Stephen agreed. But Jack said, "Heavens, Lucy, I couldn't eat another thing today, except perhaps with some of the apple pie and a little piece of cheese. And Lucy, pray ask Killick to step up if he's below." A moment later, Killick appeared, his eyes starting from his head, and Jack said, "Killick, jump round to Rowley's, will you, and get a new pair of epaulettes. Ship them first thing tomorrow morning and have a hackney coach waiting at 8:30. I have an appointment at the Admiralty. Here's some money." "So it's all right, sir," cried Killick, his shrewish face suffused with triumph. He held out his hand and said, "If I may make so bold, give you joy, sir, give you joy with all my heart. But I knew it would be. I said so all along. I told them all it'll be all right, mate. They'll learn, the buggers." "Speaking of food," said Stephen, "will you come to Black's and dine with Sir Joseph and me and Mr. Fox tomorrow at 5:30? That is to say, in your dialect, at 4:30. If I'm through with the Admiralty by then, I should be very happy." "This is not an invitation, Aubrey. You are still a member and must pay your share." "I know I am, and very handsome it was in the committee to write to me so. But I'd sworn never to set foot in the place until I was reinstated, and the Gazette will be out tomorrow. I shall pay my scot with the greatest pleasure." In order to be through with the Admiralty by dinner time, Jack Aubrey had first to get there. And at one point this seemed to present insuperable difficulties. A little after midnight, Killick was brought back to the grapes on a shutter, drunk even by the strict naval standards, being incapable of speech or movement, however slight. He'd been tumbled in the mud. Someone had plucked out a handful of his sparse, pale hair. He'd been partially stripped. His money had been taken away from him. He had no new epaulettes, and those which he'd carried as a pattern had disappeared. Rowley didn't live over his shop, and no amount of hammering at the door could therefore rouse him, and the rival establishment was far over beyond Longacre, directly away from Whitehall. However, by dint of a great expense of spirit on Jack's part and of effort on that of the coach horse, he did arrive, very hot but properly dressed, in time for his appointment at the Admiralty. And there, in that familiar waiting room, he had time to grow cool again and to relish the sensation of being in uniform once more. Sophie had been quite right. His white breeches and his blue coat were loose about the middle where his paunch had been. But the coat and high, stiff collar still sat perfectly well on his shoulders and neck, sustaining them in the most agreeable manner. There were few other officers there, and those few only single-epauletted lieutenants who didn't presume to say anything more than "Good morning, sir," to his "Good morning, gentlemen." So presently he took up the Times. He opened it at hazard, and there, leaping out of the page before him, there stood the column from the Gazette, which, he found, couldn't be contemplated too often. "Captain Aubrey, if you please, sir," said the ancient attendant. And a moment later, Admiral Satterley, having greeted Jack most cordially, with the kindest congratulations, explained the Diane's present situation. "She was given to Bushell for the West Indies, and she was to sail next month. He's been offered the Norfolk Fencibles, which suits him tolerably well. His wife has an estate there, and which has this advantage, seeing we're so pressed for time. He can take almost no followers with him. He has a full gun room and some capital warrant officers. The midshipman's berth is short of experienced master's mates, however. I believe his stores are pretty well completed, but his complement was still 60 or 70 hands short when last I heard. Here's a list of his officers. If there are any alterations you wish to make, I'll do what I can in the short time we have at our disposal. But in your place, I shouldn't make any sweeping changes. They've not been together long enough under Bushell to feel any jealousy at his suppression, and they all know who took the Diane in the first place and who has a natural right to her. But you study the list while I sign these letters." It was an informative list, with each officer's age, service, and seniority. They were young men, upon the whole, with James Fielding at 33, the oldest and most senior of the lieutenants. He had been at sea for 21 years, 10 of them with a commission. But most of his service had been in line of battleships on blockade, and he'd seen very little action, missing Trafalgar by a week. His ship, the Canopus, was sent off to water and take in provisions at Gibraltar and Tetuan. The second lieutenant, Bamfield Elliot, obviously enjoyed a good deal of influence, having been made well before the legal age, but he'd seen almost no sea service as an officer, since a wound received in the action between the Sylph and the Flesh had kept him ashore until this appointment. The third was young Dixon, whom he knew, and then came Graham, the surgeon, Blythe, the purser, and Warren, the master, all men who'd served in respectable ships. The same applied to the gunner, carpenter, and boatswain. "Well, sir," said Jack, "I've only two observations to make. The first is that the third lieutenant's the son of an officer with whom I disagreed in Menorca. I say nothing against the young man, but he's aware of the disagreement, and he takes his father's part. It's no doubt natural, but it wouldn't make for a happy ship." "Dixon?" "His father's name was Hart until he inherited Bewley, as I recall. said the Admiral, with a look that wasn't easily interpreted. Perhaps it was knowing, perhaps inwardly amused, conceivably disapproving. In any event, Satterley was obviously aware that Aubrey was one of those who had made a cuckold of Captain Hart at Port Mahon. "Just says him. Have you any other officer to suggest?" "I'm somewhat out of touch, sir. Might I have a word with your people and see whether one of my own young men is available?" "Very well, but he'll have to be within hand's reach, you know. What's your second observation, Aubrey?" "It's about the surgeon, sir, Mr. Graham. I'm sure he's a very able man, but I've always sailed with my particular friend, Dr. Maturin." "Yes, so the First Lord told me. Mr. Graham's appointment or removal, of course, rests with the Sick and Hurt Board. And although we could induce them to offer him another ship, it was thought that under the circumstances, Dr. Maturin should travel either as though he were taking up an appointment in, let us say, Batavia, or as physician to the envoy and his suite, or even, if, as I understand, pay is of little consequence to the gentleman, as your guest. It was as well that Jack Aubrey walked into Black's quite a long time before his rendezvous with Stephen and Sir Joseph, for this was the height of the London season, and the place was crowded with country gentlemen. But Tom, the head porter, disengaging himself from a group with the usual country gentleman's inquiries, emerged from his box and, shaking Jack's hand, said, "I'm right glad to see you again, sir. The club wasn't at all the same." And a surprising number of members, some of whom he hardly knew, came up and congratulated him upon his reinstatement. It's true that some of them said they'd always known it must be so, while others told him that all was well that ended well. Yet still, the sense of friendliness and support was extremely grateful. And although by now he was pretty well aware that the winning side was most widely applauded when the victory had become evident, he was much more moved than he would have supposed. Sir Joseph and Stephen came up the steps together. And Sir Joseph said, "May I give you joy of your gazette, or has the tide already risen higher than you can bear?" "You're very good, Sir Joseph. Many, many thanks. No, the tide cannot rise too high for me. I find I have a splendid appetite for the kindness of those I respect." They went upstairs and sat at a window in the long room, drinking sherry and watching the crowded street. "I've just come from Westminster," observed Jack, "and, you know, it took me nearly half an hour. There was such a press." "Was there anything afoot in the house?" asked Blaine. "Oh, no, it was just a string of private members' bills. Very few people. I only went to see Dacres take his seat. So few people, it was only just legal, and poor fellow, he was in a sad bait since he has to post away to Plymouth this evening. Yet even so, three members asked me whether I would take sons or nephews as midshipmen. And when I go tomorrow, I dare say the same thing will happen. It's astonishing how eager people are to get rid of their boys. Though perhaps not really so very astonishing when you consider." "What did you reply?" "I said I should be very happy as long as the boy was 13 or 14 and had been at a mathematical school for at least a year, and provided he already knew enough about the sea to be some use. A new command with a ship's company you know nothing about, and no schoolmasters, no place for little boys. They are much better off in a ship of the line, where at least they can act as ballast." "Your guest has arrived, Sir Joseph," said a servant. And a few minutes later, Blaine brought Mr. Fox upstairs, a tall, slim man, well-dressed in the modern way, short, unpowdered hair, black coat, white neckcloth and waistcoat, shoes and breeches with plain buckles. Rather good-looking, self-possessed, perhaps 40. He paid a particularly obliging attention to Sir Joseph's introductions, and this favourable first impression was strengthened when they sat down to dinner in the smallest of the private rooms, a charming little octagon with a domed ceiling. And he said how happy he was to meet Captain Aubrey, whose capture of the Cacafuego in the last war had raised him to a pitch of enthusiasm exceeded only by the cutting out of the Diane, and Dr. Maturin, of whom he'd heard so much from Sir Joseph. To a natural philosopher, sir, the islands of the South China Sea must present a vast wealth of nondescript plants and birds. Was you ever there? Alas, sir, it was never my good fortune to sail farther east than the coast of Sumatra, but I hope to do better this time. I hope so, too, upon my word. I have a friend in those parts who's a great naturalist, and he assures me that even the larger mammals are hardly known with any degree of certainty, that the Dutch scarcely knew anything of the interior of Java or Sumatra, were concerned only with commerce and took no scientific interest in the country at all, were in no way natural philosophers. He has wonderful collections, and he spends what time he can spare from his official duties increasing them. But I'm sure you know of him. Stamford Raffles, the Lieutenant Governor of Java. I have never had the happiness of meeting the gentleman, but I've seen his letters. Sir Joseph Banks has shown me several, some with dried specimens and admirable descriptions of plants, and some with what seem to me most judicious suggestions for a living museum of natural history, a queue on the faunal plane. You'd like him, I'm sure. He's possessed of the most brilliant talents and an extraordinary fund of energy. I met him years ago in Penang when I was a member of the Legislative Council and he was in the company's service. He worked all day and he read all night. And between times he collected anything from tigers to shrew mice. A great linguist, too. He was of the utmost help to me when I was inquiring into the spread of Buddhism, the arrival of Mahayana Buddhism in Java. Dr. Maturin and I were present when you read your paper at Somerset House, observed Sir Joseph, and both Stephen and Jack, who had seen it in the proceedings, took the opportunity to return Fox's civilities. The talk flowed steadily, and Fox spoke of naval affairs and naval politics as they were seen from the shore, spoke intelligently with a great deal of information. It moved on to the surprises, unfortunate voyage carrying Mr. Stanhope to see another Malay sultan some years before, the voyage that had very nearly brought Stephen into the naturalist's paradise beyond the Sunda Strait. Yes, said Fox. I remember that mission well, one of Whitehall's less brilliant ideas. It would have been far better left to us. Raffles would have dealt with it on the spot, and poor Mr. Stanhope would have been spared all that weary voyage and his fatal illness. It was absurd to send a man of his age, though, to be sure, the King's representative, the Crown by proxy and entitled to a 13-gun salute, if I don't mistake. Quite right, sir, said Jack. Envoys have 13 guns. Entitled to a 13-gun salute, then, has to be a man of great family or, smiling round the table, of towering parts. He was a most amiable companion, said Stephen. We studied the Malay language together when he was well enough, and I remember his delight at the verb. No person, no number, no mood, no tense. That's the kind of verb for me, said Jack. Did you make much progress? Asked Fox. We did not, said Stephen. Ours was a deeply stupid book, written by a German and what he conceived to be French. When Mr. Stanhope's Oriental secretary joined us in India, he was as helpful as could be, and I did acquire some rudimentary notions, but the voyage was too short. This time I mean to do better, and I hope to find a Malay servant from some East Indiaman. Oh, cried Fox, there I can be of service if you wish. My Ali has a cousin Ahmed who is out of a place or about to be out of a place, a well-trained, intelligent young fellow who is with a retired Straits merchant, Mr. Waller. He died a little while ago. I should have taken him myself, but with my suite I shall have no room. If you wish, I'll tell Ali to send him round. I'm sure Mrs. Waller would give him a good character. That would be very kind indeed. I should be most obliged to you, sir. Speaking of suites, said Jack. I don't know that it'd be in order to discuss practical arrangements at this point, but before I go down to Portsmouth, I should like to hear Mr. Foxy's views on numbers and messing, so that the carpenters and joiners can get to work at once, for there's not a moment to be lost. Yet, if Sir Joseph and Dr. Matcherin don't mind, perhaps we might deal with the question straight away, replied Fox, for, as you so rightly say, we cannot spare a minute. I've been in ships that try to beat into the northeast monsoon, having missed the southwest, and it's terribly wearing to the spirit, as well as being fatal to success in a case like ours. While these arrangements were being worked out, Stephen and Blaine, who were side by side, exchanged views on the wine they were drinking with their lamb, a delightful Saint-Julien, and about other wines from the Médoc, the extraordinary variations in their price, the pitiful nonsense of most talk on the subject. So, although I shall leave with only a secretary and a couple of servants, said Fox, summing up, when we touch at Batavia, Raffles will find me two or three imposing but largely ornamental figures who, together with their servants, will counterbalance the French mission. And obviously I shall need room for them. Poulo Prebang, said Stephen after a pause. The name has been reminding me of two things ever since I first heard it, and now they're coming to the surface of what I facetiously call my memory. The first is that in your lecture, sir, you spoke of it as exhibiting some of the very few remains of Buddhism in the country of the Malays. Yes, said Fox, smiling. It's an exceedingly interesting place from many points of view, and I long to see it. The Sultan is, of course, a Mahometan, like most Malays. But, like most Malays, he is also far from zealous. And as one usually finds in those parts, he and his people retain many other pieties, beliefs, superstitions, call them what you please. And he would never, never disturb the Buddhist sanctuary at Kumai, nor would anyone else. That would be the height of folly. Sacrilege, and what is perhaps even more to the point, ill luck forever. The man who told me about the temple thought he could make out Hinayana influences, which would make it unique. Geologically, the island is of great interest too, being the site of two ancient volcanic eruptions that have left vast and remarkably perfect craters. One by the sea, where the Sultan has his port, and the other high in the mountains. The second is now a lake, and by it stand the temple and the sanctuary. My informant says that the few monks come from Ceylon, but as our conversation was in French, a language neither of us spoke at all well, I may be mistaken. Perhaps it was their right that came from Ceylon. At all events, I'm quite sure Raffles said that the orangutan and the rhinoceros were to be seen, and I believe he mentioned the elephant. What joy, said Stephen. And that brings me to my second point. Surely Poulo Prebang is the place to which Van Buren retired when we took Java, is it not? Van Buren. I don't think I recall the name. Cornelius van Buren. Some people put him on a level with Cuvier, some even higher. In any case, there is no greater authority on the spleen. The anatomist? Of course. Forgive me, my wits were astray. I'm afraid I don't know what happened to him, but Raffles will certainly tell us. From the anatomist, they went on to those who supplied anatomists with what Blaine pleasantly described as their raw material. Resurrection men, hangman's assistants, the Thames watermen. There are also those who are on what is called the smothering lay, men who entice benighted youths or countrymen who have had their pockets picked to a kipping ken, and when they're asleep lay another mattress on them and lie upon it themselves, two or three together. From wicked men in general they pass to traitors in particular, and then, quite abruptly, to Ledwood. And both Jack and Stephen were astonished at Foxy's passionate hatred of the man, the more so as their recent talk had been light, almost trifling. Fox was so moved that he spoke grossly, obviously an unusual thing with him, and oddly grating. Turned pale, and ate no more until the cloth was drawn and port and walnuts were on the table, and when the coming and going of servants necessarily changed the subject. He recovered fairly soon, however, and they sat long over their wine, the decanter twice renewed, and the dinner ending very cheerfully. He declined their invitation to go with them to a concert of ancient music. To his great regret, he couldn't tell one note from another. Thanked them handsomely for the pleasure, the very great pleasure of their company, and for his excellent dinner, and so took his leave. While Jack was talking to a friend in the hall of the concert room, Stephen said to Blaine, "There was another point I thought of raising, but didn't. I should have mentioned it to you long before. I trust I'm right in supposing that there is no question of hierarchy, no question of relative rank where the envoy and I are concerned." "Oh, no, none whatsoever. It's perfectly understood that although Fox will ask your advice if any difficulty should arise, he's not required to follow it. On the other hand, you are under no obligation to follow his recommendations either. There's nothing but a consultative nexus. He is in Pulau Prabang to conclude a treaty with the Sultan. You are there to observe the French. Though, naturally, you'll communicate any intelligence that may come into your possession and that may help him in his task." "Stephen, a very good morning to you," said Jack, looking up from his letter. "I hope you slept well." "Admirably well, I thank you. Lord, how I love the smell of coffee, bacon, toasted bread. Do you remember a very horrible midshipman called Richardson?" "I do not." "Spotty Dick, they used to call him in the Boadicea. He had more pimples than were quite right, even in the Navy. We saw him again in Bridgetown, Admiral Pellow's flag lieutenant. He'd quite lost them by then." "So we did too. A mathematician, as I recall. What of him?" "He's on the beach. So I sent down to ask whether he'd like to be third in the Diane. And here's his letter, overflowing with delight and gratitude. I'm so glad. Now, do you remember Mr. Muffet, the captain of the Lushington Indiaman, when we had our brush with Lenoir on the way back from Sumatra? Well done, Stephen. He's made the Canton voyage God knows how many times, and he knows the South China Sea intimately well, which I do not. I wrote to ask his advice, and here," waving another letter, "he invites me down to Greenwich. He's retired from the sea, but loves to watch the ships go up and down the river." Mrs. Broad came in to say good day, and to bring more bacon and a dish of Leadenhall sausages, three of which Stephen instantly devoured. "No one would think," he said indistinctly through the third, "that I'd had a good dinner yesterday and an excellent supper." "The club's port was the best I've drunk for years," said Jack. "Fox studied remarkably well. Never a tremor as he went downstairs, which is more than could be said for Worsley and Hammond and some other members. What did you think of him?" "Sure, my first impression was good. And he's certainly an intelligent, knowledgeable man. But this impression didn't last quite as well as I could have wished. He laid a great compliment on his speech as though he wished us to love him. And perhaps he talked a little too much, as barristers so often do. But then, until you know a man well, it's hard to know how much to put down to nervousness. And it is a nervous thing to be outnumbered 3-1. Sir Joseph, who is better acquainted with him, rates his abilities very high. Likes him too, I believe. And it was pleasant to hear him speak with such generous enthusiasm of his friend in Batavia, Raffles." He rang for more coffee, and pouring Jack a cup, he went on, "Few men like to be trampled upon. But it seems to me that some go too far in avoiding it and try to assume a dominating position from the start, or at least as soon as the first civilities are over. Dr. Johnson said that every meeting or every conversation was a contest in which the man of superior parts was the victor. But I think he was mistaken. for that is surely wrangling or hostile debate, often self-defeating. It's not conversation, as I understand it at all. A calm, amicable interchange of opinions, news, information, reflections, without any striving for superiority. I particularly noticed that Sir Joseph, indulging in several of his masterly flashes of silence, rather prolonged flashes, remained quite obviously the most considerable man among us. Jack nodded and breakfasted on. He had now reached toast and marmalade, and when he'd emptied the nearer rack, he said, "Years ago I should have thought he was a great man and excellent company, but I've grown more reserved since then. A cantankerous old dog rather than a friendly young one. And although he may indeed be a great man, I shall not make up my mind till I know him better. You didn't hear us arranging his accommodation in Diane. He has exactly Mr. Stanhope's ideas of the importance of an envoy, the direct representative of the Crown. We shall mess separately, except for particular invitations, though the extra bulkheads will make clearing the ship for action a longer, more complicated affair. And by the way, you've not told me how you prefer to travel, as physician to the envoy and his suite, or as my guest?" "Oh, as your guest, Jack, if you please. It would be so much simpler, and they can always ask for my services if they need them." "I'm sure you're right," said Jack. "Stephen, I'm away to Buckmaster's in 5 minutes. My uniform no longer fits. Will not you come with me? You could do with a decent coat." "Alas, brother, I'm taken up this morning. They have an interesting, delicate operation with my friend Aston at Guy's, and you will be at the house in the afternoon. But let's meet in the evening and go to the opera, if Sir Joseph will lend us his box. They're playing La Clemenza di Tito." "I shall look forward to it," said Jack. "And perhaps tomorrow we'll take a boat down to Greenwich." Stephen's operation went well, although throughout its not inconsiderable length the patient cried, "Oh God, oh Jesus, oh no, 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 no more for God's sake. Oh God, I can't bear it." The rapid flow of words broken by screams, for the frailty of his teeth and the state of his nose forbade the efficient use of a gag. And this Stephen found unusually tiring. So instead of calling on Sir Joseph Banks at Spring Grove, as he'd intended, he sat in an easy chair by the window in his room at the Grapes and looked first for Van Buren's essay on the spleen in primates, the zoological primates, in the Journal des Scavins, and found that it was indeed dated from Poulo-Probagne. Then he searched back among those diaries he'd preserved. Some had been taken, sunk or destroyed, and he found that of the year in which he first met Jack Aubrey. He hadn't used this particular code for a great while, and at first he'd offered some difficulty, but in time he was reading fluently enough. "Yes," he said, "even as late as that I was stunned entirely, I find. No feelings at all but sorrow. And even that a dull grey. Music, the only living thing." He read on, going faster now, and catching the mood of his former self, not so much from the entries as from all the associations they brought back to vivid present life. "Should have changed from the man who could speak such words to Dylan," he said. "But it is rather a recovery from an enormous blow, a reversion to a former state, than an evolution. The change in Jack is in fact more considerable, for even the most prescient eye could scarcely have seen the present Captain Aubrey in the wilful, indeed wanton, undisciplined Jack of those days, somewhat profligate and so impatient of restraint. Or do I exaggerate?" He turned the pages, running through his first contacts with naval intelligence. "Dear John Somerville, the fourth generation of a family of Barcelona merchants, a member of the Germandat, the Catalan Brotherhood struggling against the Spanish, the Castilian oppression of their country, the Catalans' hatred for the French armies that had burnt Montserrat and ravaged towns, villages, and even remote isolated mountain farms, destroying, raping, murdering. The German Dutch's total refusal when, in 1797, the Castilians deserted their English allies and joined the French. The appalling successes of Bonaparte's campaigns, and Stephen's realization that the only hope for Europe was an English victory which must be won at sea, and that this victory was a necessary condition for both Catalan autonomy and Irish independence. The diary recorded his connection with Somerville after his early days in the Sophie and with Somerville's English chief, one of Blaine's best agents until his horrible death in France. Recorded it in much too much detail. And though to be sure the code never had been broken, some of the entries made him shudder even now. What insane risks he'd run before he came to understand the true nature of intelligence. Lucy brought him abruptly back to the present by knocking at the door and saying, in a voice that showed neither pleasure nor approval, that there was a black man downstairs with a letter for Dr. Maturin. "Is he a seaman, Lucy?" asked Stephen, his bemused mind turning to some one of the black members of the Surprise's crew now thousands of miles away. "No, sir," said Lucy. "He's more like a native." And leaning forward, she added in a low tone, "He has black teeth." "Pray bring him up." It was Foxy's Ahmed. And although his teeth were indeed quite black from the chewing of beetle, his face was only a moderate brownish yellow. At this juncture it wore an anxious expression, and he stood there bowing in the doorway, holding the letter in both hands. He was wearing European clothes, and in many parts of the town, particularly down by the pool or Wapping, he would have passed unnoticed. But the liberties of the Savoy was not one of them. In fact, legally, it wasn't part of London or Westminster at all, but of the Duchy of Lancaster, and culturally it was a self-contained village with no notion at all of natives, nor even of people from the Surrey side. "Ahmed," said Stephen, "come in." The letter was a friendly note from Fox, saying how much he had enjoyed their dinner, and enclosing a testimonial from Mrs. Waller, who gave Ahmed an excellent character, but said that he found England a little cold and damp in the winter, that he would probably thrive better on his native heath, and that in any case she was obliged to reduce her household. "I see," said Stephen. "Ahmed, how much English do you speak? And has Ali explained the situation to you?" Ahmed said he spoke little but understood more. Ali had explained everything, and on being asked when he could leave his place, said, "Pumoro, Tuan," bowing again. "Very well," said Stephen. "The wages are £15 a year. If that suits, bring your things here before noon. Can you manage your chest?" "Oh, yes, yes, Tuan. Ali so kind with cart." Ahmed bowed again and again, backed slowly to the door and even down the first few stairs, smiling as brilliantly as his dim teeth would allow. "Now I shall have to calm Killick and Mrs. Broad," reflected Stephen. "He is likely to grow more shrewish than usual, and she is certain to think of human sacrifices and heathens running amok. A difficult interview, I foresee." It was, indeed, heavy going at first. "Bears I have borne, sir, and badgers," said Mrs. Broad, her arms folded over a formal black silk dress. "It was only a very small bear," said Stephen, "and long ago." "And badgers. Several large badgers in the outhouse," continued Mrs. Broad. "But them black teeth fairly curdle the blood in your veins." Yet, it being Dr. Maturin, and since Mrs. Maturin was quite used to black teeth in India, Sunday's trial were eventually conceded. And before the end of those days, the grape's blood was flowing quite normally. Ahmed, always clean, sober, meek and obliging, passed in and out, exciting no adverse comment. Whereas, by contrast, Killick, ashore, was often something of a nuisance, always noisy and frequently drunk. And when, at the end of their stay in London, a cart came to carry them and the baggage to the Portsmouth coach, Mrs. Broad, Lucy and Nancy shook Ahmed by the hand as well as Mr. Killick, and wished him a prosperous voyage and a happy return. They would be very pleased to see him again. Jack and Stephen had left earlier by post-chaise, and when they were clear of the town, the horses stepping out briskly, Jack said, "I wish Tom Pullings were with us. He does so love riding in a chaise and four." "Where would he be by now, do you suppose?" asked Stephen. "If they picked up the trades well north of the line, they might be somewhere near Cape Saint Roch." "I hope so, I'm sure. I hate to think of the surprise rolling our masts out and spewing our oakum in the doldrums." He shuffled among the papers on the seat beside him. "Here are my orders. Admiralty orders, I'm happy to say, so that if by any improbable chance we take a prize, there will be no iniquitous admiral's third. And here's what Muffet sent me this morning. Most obliging of him. Extracts from his logs in the South China Sea these 25 years past and more. Charts, remarks on typhoons, currents, variations of the compass, and the setting in of the monsoons. It's extremely valuable. And it would be even more so if the Indiamen didn't keep as close as they could to an established course from Canton to the Sunda Strait. They can hardly do otherwise in a sea that, as far as anyone can tell, is nowhere more than 100 fathom water and generally less than 50. A shallow, unexplored sea with volcanoes all round and therefore sudden, unexpected shoals. It's not blue water sailing at all. And, as he frankly told me down at Greenwich, they often prefer to lie to at night, or even anchor, which is easy enough in such modest depths. A very sensible precaution, too. I wonder everyone doesn't adopt it." "Why, Stephen, some people are in a hurry. Men of war, for instance. It's no good carrying your pig to market and finding..." He paused, frowning. "It will not drink?" "No, it ain't that, neither. That there are no pokes to be had. Oh, I'll be damned to literary airs and graces. It's no good hurrying, as we have been hurrying these last few days, and carrying your ship halfway round the world, cracking on to make all sneer again, if you're going to balance your mizzen all night once you pass Java Head. Lord, Stephen, I'm quite fagged with running about London so. Pillar and post ain't in it." He yawned, made some indistinct remarks about time and tide, and went to sleep in his corner, going out like a light. His usual habit. He was bright awake, however, well before the chaise reached Ashgrove, and he gazed out at his plantations, now in finer leaf than when last he saw them, and at the rather stunted shrubs along the drive with delight. He was expected, for the clash of the new iron gate could be heard a great way off. And with even greater delight he saw his family in front of the house, the children waving already. But as he jumped out, he saw with concern that, in spite of her welcome, Sophie looked thoroughly upset, her smile constrained, her whole attitude anxious. Mrs. Williams was looking very grave. Diana was taken up with telling Stephen about a horse. The children seemed unaffected. "A dreadful thing's happened," said Sophie as soon as she had him alone. "Your brother, my brother since he's yours and I love him dearly." Sophie, when moved, had a way of talking very quick, her words tumbling over one another. "I mean, dear Philip, of course, has run away from school and he declares he'll go to sea with you." "Is that all?" cried Jack with great relief. "Where is he?" "On the landing. He dared not come down." Jack opened the door and hailed, "Ho! Philip there, come down, old fellow." And when he came, "Why, brother, how glad I am to see you."
"Give you joy, sir," said Philip in a trembling voice.
"That's kind of you, Philip," said Jack, shaking his hand, "and it grieves me all the more to disappoint you. But this won't do, do you see? I cannot take my own brother as a youngster in a new command where I know none of the people and they know nothing about me. All the fellows in the midshipman's berth, and everybody else for that matter, would put you down as a favourite at once. It wouldn't do. Upon my word, it wouldn't do. But don't take it too hard. Next year, if you mind your mathematics, Captain Dundas will take you in the Orion. I promise, a ship of the line. He has plenty of squeakers of your age. Don't take it too hard." He turned away because Philip was almost certainly going to cry. And Sophie said, "There was a message from the Commissioner asking you to call as soon as you could." "I shall write him a note at once, and another inviting poor Bushell of the Diane to dinner tomorrow. Or would that put you out, my dear?"
"Not in the least, my love."
"Then please tell Bondon to stand by, dressed like a Christian, to go down with Dre as soon as the letters are wrote." Jack knew very well that the Commissioner would have to confer with the Master Shipwright to put the Navy Board's order into just the right shape, and indeed to start the urgent work even before the order had a formal existence. The highly skilled confidential joiners who were to fashion places for the treasure had already come down, treasure which, combined with the envoy's less tangible offerings, would outweigh anything the French could provide. At least, that was what the ministry hoped. He'd never met Captain Bushell, and his invitation was necessarily formal. But he put it in as friendly a manner as he could, hoping that it might make the supersession slightly less painful. It appeared to have no such effect, however. Bondon brought back a note in which Captain Bushell regretted that a previous engagement prevented him from accepting Captain Aubrey's invitation. He ventured to suggest that Captain Aubrey should come aboard tomorrow at 3:30. Captain Aubrey would understand that Captain Bushell, having introduced the officers, should prefer to leave the ship before his successor was read in. The note came when Captain Aubrey was deep in a very earnest game of speculation, the children hooting and roaring steadily. Philip had recovered his spirits. His niece Caroline was particularly kind in guiding his play, and his eyes sparkled as he piped his bids. At the moment Jack only took notice of the refusal, and then carried on with his plot for undermining George, who had little notion of the laws of probability. But later he reflected that Bushell must be rather a pitiful fellow to resent his displacement to such a pitch. The previous engagement might possibly exist, but the total lack of any formal compliments or thanks for the invitation was churlish, while the appointing of a time was most incorrect, and the failure to offer a boat to take him out was shabby in the extreme. It would be perfectly in order for Jack to choose his own date and his own hour. He was senior to Bushell by several years. But although he had never been superseded himself, he knew it was generally a most disagreeable process, perhaps so disagreeable in this case that it justified a high degree of resentment. "Anyhow," he said, "I shall follow the scrub's directions." And in a more inward voice, scarcely a whisper to his private being, he said, "Indeed, I should do anything short of slaughtering Sophie and the children to be in my place again." For although he had been gazetted, and although his name was on the list, it was the symbolic and, for the sea officer, quasi-sacramental reading in that would pass the ring and marry him to the Navy once more. They drove down all four in Diana's coach, with Killick and Bondon up behind. A sight that would have made London stare, but that was usual enough around Portsmouth, Chatham and Plymouth.
For after Jack had done his business with the Commissioner and had taken possession of the Diane, they were to dine at the Crown, and the women were to be shown the ship. The Commissioner and Master Shipwright deeply relished anything in the secret line. They were as brisk and cooperative as could be. The confidential joiner's work would be masked by the alterations necessary for the envoy and his people. And when Jack said he was going across to the Diane, the Commissioner immediately offered his own barge to take him. The frigate was lying conveniently near at hand, just this side of Whale Island, and it was clear that Captain Bushell was still removing his belongings. Boats were plying to and fro. "Pull around, will you?" said Jack to the coxswain, for there was still some time to go. "Pull easy." He gazed at her with intense concentration, shading his eyes from the bright sunlight. Trim, shipshape, prettier than he'd remembered her. She must have had a good first lieutenant. A trifle by the stern, perhaps, but otherwise he couldn't fault her. Two leisurely circuits, and he looked at his watch again. "Larboard," he said. And to avoid the awkwardness of the coxswain calling out Diane when her nominal captain was still aboard. Up the side, man ropes, but no ceremony. He saluted the quarterdeck, and every hat came off in reply, a simultaneous flash of gold. "Captain Bushell," he said, advancing with his hand held out. "Good afternoon, sir. My name is Aubrey." Bushell gave him a limp hand, a mechanical smile, and a look of hatred. "Good afternoon to you, sir. Allow me to name my officers." They came forward in turn, the first lieutenant Fielding, the second Elliot. "My third, Mr. Dixon, has been removed, and is to be replaced, as I understand it, by a person of your choosing," said Bushell. "Then the solitary marine officer, Welby. Warren, the master, the fine-looking man. Graham, the surgeon. The purser, Blythe." They all looked gravely and attentively at him, and as he shook their hands, he did the same by them. The little knot of midshipmen were not introduced. As soon as it was over, Bushell called out, "My barge!" It was, in fact, already hooked on to the starboard main chains, with white-gloved sideboys waiting by the gangway stanchions, and in a moment the farewell ceremony was in train. With a rhythmic stamp and clash, the marines presented arms. All the officers attended him to the side, and the boatswain and his mates sprung their calls. In some ships, the crew cheered their departing captain. In this case, the Dianes only stared heavily, some chewing on their quids, others open-mouthed, all completely indifferent. When the barge was at a proper distance, Jack drew his order from his inner pocket and, handing it to the first lieutenant, said, "Mr. Fielding, be so good as to have all hands called aft and read them this." Again the calls howled and twittered. The ship's company came flocking aft along the gangways and in the waist and stood there, silent, waiting. Jack withdrew almost to the taffrail, looking down at this strangely familiar quarterdeck, which he had last seen flowing with blood, some of it his own. In a strong voice, Fielding cried, "Off hats!" And to the bareheaded crew he read, "By the Commissioners for executing the office of Lord High Admiral of Great Britain and Ireland, etc., and of all His Majesty's plantations, etc., to John Aubrey, Esquire, hereby appointed captain of His Majesty's ship, the Diane. By virtue of the power and authority to us given, we do hereby constitute and appoint you captain of His Majesty's ship, the Diane, willing and requiring you forthwith to go on board and take upon you the charge and command of captain in her accordingly, strictly charging and commanding the officers and company belonging to the said ship, subordinate to you to behave themselves jointly and severally in their respective employments, with all due respect and obedience to you, their said captain, and you likewise to observe and execute as well the general printed instructions as what orders and directions you shall from time to time receive from us or any other your superior officers for His Majesty's service. Hereof nor you, nor any of you may fail as you will answer the contrary at your peril. And for so doing this shall be your warrant, given under our hands and the seal of the Office of Admiralty on this 15th day of May, in the 53rd year of His Majesty's reign.